All right. Off to a very good start with Paul Chambers and the Paul Chambers Quintet with I Heard That. Did you hear that? Okay. That's Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Cannonball Adderley on alto sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers, the man himself, on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. Believe it or not, that was recorded in 1959, or as people are apt to say of that age, that was recorded in 1959 for the album Go on VJ Records. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and you're listening to the best program ever, ever, ever. Why? Because it includes you. And we are retooling. We're getting ready to do some different things, and in which the listeners will be featured as instructors, as it were. They will be guiding us through some very interesting knowledge, pools of knowledge that we would need to have in order to make sense of the times we're living in. Okay, so let's start. Oh, before I do, let me make this little announcement. I will be announcing some names very shortly, and those names are people I hope will send me a way to contact you, preferably by phone. We need to have a small conversation to get this whole thing off the ground. So I'm excited. Okay, so listen out for your name. Representative Brenda Lawrence, who represents Michigan's 14th Congressional District, announced Tuesday, that's yesterday, that she'll be leaving at the end of her term. She'll be the 25th House Democrat and the 36th member of that body to quit. Although 11 of them have intentions to run for the U.S. Senate or for governor in their respective states. It's a sign that they may be out, but not down. They're just switching focus. Just the same, the exodus from the House will have significant impact. And we're going to be talking about what ways will this significant impact affect politics as you know it? In what ways is it likely to manifest itself? That's a lot of people to be quitting. And I invite you to render your observations and comments and analyses of just that. What is with, well, it's not unusual, to be very honest. It's not unusual for members of Congress to leave after a while, especially after they have served in the House for a long time and they want to switch over to the Senate. So that's not particularly unusual. It happens all the time. But we still must pay attention to the fact that 36 members so far have sent signals that they are ready to quit. That says something. What is that something that it says? And what does that therefore suggest that we begin to think about? I mean, it's clear what the situation is. A lot of people are quitting. But so what? What's next? 888-874-4888. Let's get down to brass tacks here and figure out what does this exodus have to do with what is about to happen politically? In what ways is it likely to manifest itself? In what ways do you think this is also a moment of opportunity? With that many people gone, it means that there will be available seats. What could be done in a moment like this if people were savvy in their politics? 888-874-4888. What are you thinking out there? You see, the thing is, in every situation, in every, as they say, in every crisis, there is also opportunity. What is there an opportunity for when 36 members of Congress decide to hang it up? Some will move on and run for Senate. Some will move on and run for governor in their particular states. But is it all bad necessarily? Is there something here that could send a message to those with political aspirations that they better sharpen their tools? Ed from Queens, you start us off today.
Hey, good afternoon, Chief. How you doing?
Okay, Ed, good afternoon to you.
Yeah, me and my phone still here, still hanging.
Still hanging.
Well, what this indicates to me fundamentally is two things. What has happened to the Democratic Party? They're devoid of leadership, they're devoid of direction, and a lot of people are electing to abandon ship and move on with their careers, whatever they might be, respectively. I don't think a lot of the members that are leaving the Congress will be going to the Senate. I believe that they are just going to disabuse themselves of the Republican part of the Democratic Party, excuse me, because the Democratic Party is sorely lacking. And I see a big midterm. I see, well, traditionally when one party of this quote unquote two party system has won the presidency or the executive office, there's a shift for the Congress and the Senate to the other party. So I see a Republican upsurge. There's a lot of depression in the country. There's a lot of doubt in the country. There's a lot of angst. And unfortunately, during those periods of time, con men, hucksters, i.e. Donald Trump, i.e. Mitch McConnell, use those circumstances to promote a solution and to promote themselves. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans buy into it. And Donald Trump did it with the wall. Biden and Clinton did it with the black community and jailing black men as far as the crime bill. When there is a deficit in the country, our political leaders really have no foresight or intelligence, as far as I'm concerned, use that and appeal to the baser instinct of fear, of anger, of prejudice, and use that to promote themselves and their agendas. So I think that as far as opportunity goes, this would be a golden opportunity for people outside of that mindset to run for office. Traditionally, Congress has been a place where local people, local fixtures in the community run for office, get in there and push an agenda for 2 years, and then get out. It's supposed to be a quick turnover. The Congress was traditionally the house of the common people, and the Senate was more of the rich landowners as far as American politics go, if you're looking at it from an historical standpoint. So there's an opportunity there, but I don't think there's any political third party or any outside force that can really take that opportunity and use it as it should be done.
Even though the signals have been sent, do you believe that the parties that could or should respond in the manner that you're talking about are going to take advantage of the opportunity to do so?
I don't believe they can. Number one, I don't believe financially, just as a matter of political mathematics or political physics, I don't believe financially they have the wherewithal to do it. I don't believe socially that any party is bringing out a clear message of unity and a clear message that we can rally behind. Parties used to have platforms. Parties used to have standards and objectives. Mm-hmm. And there's no clear third party, in my opinion, that is manifesting that clear enough and loud enough to incite people to vote. I may be wrong. I hope I'm wrong, because I don't have a pulse of the entire nation. But I know here on the Northeast, in New York, and New Jersey, Connecticut area, there's no third party to speak of. I mean, you've got the Green Party. You've got some form of the People's Party. You've got the people with Larry Hamm in New Jersey, but they are primarily local issues. As far as on the national scene, I don't see any real force that's going to drive people to the polls. But like I said, I always hope I'm wrong.
Well, here we are with yet another example of the nearsightedness of particularly the Democratic Party. The person I referred to from the outset, Brenda Lawrence, represents Michigan's 14th district. She's an African-American woman. She's been in office for quite some time. One would think that her announcement would not happen in, a vacuum, that by the time she announces, there would be also a corroborating announcement saying, we are looking for the best replacement we can. We are sorry to see her go, but good luck to whatever her next steps are. But we have people in mind, or some send a message of continuity, or that the party is not being taken by surprise about this. Of course it isn't, but that it has a plan.
Well, you see, that's the problem. This party has no vision. They both have no vision. They both don't have... People don't know the political process anymore. They don't know the mechanics behind it, how you cultivate leaders, how you draw from the populace and cultivate and motivate and create leaders based on your platform, based on what you're standing for. When you're only standing for yourself, when you're only standing for empire, when you're only standing for... i.e. the bottom line, money, dollars, which is what both of these parties stand for, you can't cultivate. You can't pull someone out of the ranks and mature. You can't find an intelligent, articulate individual and mold them into a congressman, a senator, eventually the executive office, the president, because you have no backbone. You have no character. You have no sense of commitment. You're just looking at the bottom line, the dollar sign. They're empty suits. They're empty suits. Men without chests.
All right.
You can't motivate anybody when you're like this.
You gave us a good overview in your answer. Thank you very much. And
one more thing.
I agree with you, actually.
One more thing.
I agree with you.
I hope I'm one of the names you mentioned.
You never know.
I hope so.
Hang in there.
Thank you.
Wayne from New York, you're on the air.
I love Ed, and on those things we agree, but I'm going to disagree. I think there's no hope, and I hate to say that in such a stark way, but I think that you have two groups of people that are leaving. One group are people that actually have a shred of integrity and know that they can't move anywhere. They can't go forward on anything because the corporations, the corporate dictatorship of this world right now will not allow that to be. So that's one kind of person I think is leaving. The other type is leaving to get in deeper with the corporate state, and they're going to get a better job, especially since they've got that insight of being in the government. I'm going to tell you that I would find it impossible for any candidate with any shred of integrity right now to win anything, particularly at this time under this COVID spell. Right now, you have people that are moving up that are simply not qualified to flush the toilet, and they're getting put into very high positions. And so at this point, the only thing I see, the only movement to people moving up are the people that go do the go along to get along all the time. I believe the powers that are at the top are taking their orders from the corporate state, who are letting them know, this is what you have to do. Here's your assignment. We're moving to mandatory vaccines. I believe that's going to happen. I'm watching Kathy Hochul very carefully in the state of New York. I'm watching who she's appointing, and it's stunning to me who she's appointing, because they are blobs, bump on the logs, that have done nothing in office since they've been there except for take up space. So it was always hard, and I know this firsthand, and I know because I have a very, very progressive platform. I'm very appealing when I go speak to people in an audience. And it was really incredibly hard. I mean, I even had people that were following me during the campaign. And you can't get in that door unless you are going to do the go-along to get-along. And the woman that I ran against was the biggest facilitator in the gentrification of Harlem and East Harlem. Mike Bloomberg was the mayor. He made it clear what he wanted. He had two lapdogs to pick from. And a lapdog on the east side got it. And, you know, this was devastating. Devastating. The corridor of 125th Street has been completely changed. You have incredible rents in Harlem where nobody could make those rents anymore. You hardly see any black people when you go there anymore. You go up there and it's like, sooner or later, it's going to be, well, this was a place where, and you'll have all the signs up. But you won't see any people. So, you know, we were already headed in that direction, but COVID has given them the biggest excuse to start really, really knocking people around. So I think that when you see people that are exiting, they're exiting out of sheer frustration because they know they can't do anything. And really, this is what the higher-ups want. They really want those people, the people that want to do anything that's progressive or changing or doing something good for their constituents, they want them out of there. They want people that are going to be in there. They're going to listen to the straight and narrow. You're going to get over there. You're going to do what I say. If not, guess what? And you can see how easy it is to bump people out. I am not a fan of Governor Cuomo, but I got to tell you, it's amazing to me that just by pointing a finger at somebody, just by pointing a finger, they didn't even have a trial. They didn't bring any kind of legal case. They just got him out of there. And you know, whether you like him or not, you had to look at the figures of how much he was a very popular governor at the time. And I just think we're in that day where, it's super easy to get you out. We learned a lot from Jeffrey Epstein. We learned about blackmail. Jeffrey Epstein was a professional blackmailer. This is what he did. The technique, it has been around for years. It's been around since, the mafia was here in the 1920s. He perfected it. He got everybody to get in bed with somebody that was younger, so he could always have that over their head. Of course, Jeffrey Epstein was just a stooge, too. He wasn't really making any decisions, but it's the way
you're straying. You're straying. Come
Sorry.
Back.
Well, that's
come
an example.
Back.
That was just an
come
example.
Come back.
Okay, so that was simply an example. What I'm trying to say now, that you can't be in political office unless there is something that they have on you. If you don't have anything in your background that you can be blackmailed with, it's very hard to get in because they want to
control
people.
Let me ask you this, Gwen.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing, I mean, this is not news in politics, that in a situation like this, there's going to be massive turnover at some point. There's a new president, a new administration, there will be turnover. And especially those who consider themselves, the older ones, will want to shift. They've had enough of the House of Representatives, and it's time for new vistas, so they're going to try to, their luck at perhaps a Senate seat or some other political seat. But doesn't it strike you odd that knowing the rhythm of how these things work, politics works and the changing of the guard that usually occurs. We have 36 people leaving, and nobody independent. We don't hear anybody from the new way coming forward or preparing to run for office in the House. How come?
Because I think that most people feel it's pointless. I hate to say that because, you know, you have to have that new energy you're talking about, you know, that's been so bogged down. That's been so beaten down. And even with the, you know, the squad that came in and where people had some hope, I'm just talking about hope now, that maybe they could bring some change. They've gotten bogged. They can't do anything either. So then you have to go back. I think I was discussing this with somebody this morning, and I think that what you really need to keep your eye on is, first of all, there is going to be a world government in place and it's already here, it's underneath, and it's dictating the terms of all local governments. And that's the one you got to watch out for, because that's the one that's going to be very draconian, and that's what you need to keep an eye on. And I think also insiders that are in politics know this and sense it, and they feel a sense of helplessness because they can't do very much for their own communities, because it won't be passed. The people that are really in charge will just totally stop whatever good things they're trying to do. It's pointless. And why keep banging your head against the wall?
You don't see any opportunity at all opening up for third parties or for independents?
No. No. Are you kidding me? No way. Not right now. The people in the United States are polarized. They are so polarized but because of the campaign, this vaccine campaign, that everybody's assuming you're in the right wing and you're a Donald Trumper if you're you know, anti-vax, and the parties are almost switching, but the platforms are still very clear. There's only two platforms. There's a Democrat, there's a Republican, and I see them. I heard it even this morning when I was listening to the radio, even on programs like Democracy Now, talking about the left wing media versus the right wing. Why is there a left and right wing? Why isn't there just a media telling us the news? Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So there's really an agenda here. And I really think that if you know your politics, you've grown weary of trying to change people's minds. And also, how can you change anybody when people themselves are willing to throw the towel in so easily? I mean, you know, my parents are Roosevelt Democrats. I grew up in a Roosevelt Democratic family. You think everybody in my family they are super progressive. But when it came to this vaccine crap, they totally threw the towel in. They became fascists. They would like to see their own daughter locked up for not taking a vaccine. Are you kidding me? So what is that? That is not left wing. To me, that's right wing. So everybody's so confused, except for they're polarized in their camp. And then you have people, you know, like me in the middle, where I'm certainly not a right winger, but I'm certainly not going to put some poison in my vein just because you tell me to. So I think that at this point, people are weary. They've been isolated for so long and terrorized by the TV that I think they're going to, you know, when people don't know what to do, they stay put. They don't do anything. That's the masses I'm talking about. I'm not talking about new parties, but I'm going to tell you it's going to be really, really hard to stir up anything right now, because I think that if you want to bring a new party in, you have to have a hope. You really have to be in some kind of a hopeful environment saying, this is what can happen. But people are afraid to have any hope.
You also have to have an investment. And it seemed as if the independent parties, the progressive parties, and so forth, just decided to coast along.
Right, right.
You don't see a strong effort to recruit and register people. You don't see the party talking about issues the way they ought to, and being visible in the community, and they can't do much, they can't achieve much on the cusp of a major change like this.
Right, and remember how bogged down they had people are with their financial stuff. I mean, now, this government is completely, I mean, people in the United States, a lot of them are not back to work. That's a huge problem. So they're also bogged down with that on their mind. They can only think of two things. Can I get a job and this disease? So you think they're going to run out now and start creating new political parties?
Well, that's their job. That's part of what they're supposed to do.
But you know, Eutrice, it always the job of the person who does this starts out with the person who's a volunteer and or an activist usually. And then it becomes a job. But at the beginning, you have to have
the fire. You have to have leadership. That's right. It doesn't take a surprise move for people to realize, oh my God, we're losing 36 members of the House. What are we going to do? This is not the time to think that or to ask that silly question.
Right, but people are so cynical. They don't care. You know what they think? They think 33 rats just jumped off the ship. Big freaking deal. Who cares? Who cares? Do they represent us? No, they don't represent us. We get zero in the way of services for the most part. So why should I care? I'm still standing by myself over here. You don't throw me a lifeline. You keep making it harder and harder for people to live here. And I think America has become so jaded and worn out from all the games and having our minds constantly fooled around with. I mean, you know, this constant thing of terror. It's just, I think people just are like, enough. I'm done with it. I just want to go to my cocoon and forget about this.
All right.
I'm living my life best I can.
We'll take a break here. We've gotten two very strong views. I like that. So I thank you both, Ed and Gwen, for putting it out there as you see it. We'll take this break, come right back with another topic right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking and seeing the sides of opinions that people are offering us for consideration today. Okay, so here's a kind of esoteric question, but it really isn't. It's a very serious question. Does the state, and this was hinted at by Gwen when she was talking about, you know, how people decide how far they want to go in politics and what they have to do to be successful in it. But here's a question that I want you to answer or to think about and give us an answer. Does the state have a unilateral right to impose stringent measures to prevent extreme or dire consequences to society in a public health emergency? I'll repeat. Does the state have a unilateral right to impose, I have to read my handwriting here, to impose stringent measures to prevent extreme dire consequences in a public health emergency? That was a direct reference to the pandemic and all these various measures. They keep changing, of course, because the nature of the pandemic is changing. And many states and the nation, President Biden, basically trying to respond as things develop. But the question I want you to train your mind on is perhaps philosophical, but it's real because it is literal. It is a literal translation of that philosophical thought. Does a state have a unilateral right to impose stringent measures that some may say are anti-democratic, that incur on people's freedoms and rights, But in the face of a pandemic, and perhaps worse behind it, does the state apparatus have the unilateral right to impose stringent measures as it sees fit? That's the question. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you're thinking out there. Can the state or should the state have unilateral power to say, well, yes, we tried this yesterday, and we tried it the month before, and we tried it the month before that, but nothing is working. So we have to be flexible, and we have to understand we don't have very much time. We have to respond in a dramatic way, and this would necessarily involve the matter of people and their rights. What do you say? What is your version of this whole scenario? Does the state have the right to do things that you go, heck no, that's what Gwen just said? She says no. But I'm not so clear that everybody's clear about what we're dealing with. We're dealing here with individual rights or society's rights, as opposed to a massive and perhaps unsolvable problem if the current situation is not arrested and addressed. Does the state have the right to say, okay, we have no choice but to do X, Y, and Z, and that's what we're going to do? We don't have time to conduct further studies or take polls. We don't have time to study the literature. What we are interested in is saving lives. We have to move fast. This thing is moving even faster than we are. So we will make decisions, and we will have to go ahead with what we think will work best in this time. Jackie from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Okay, hi, good afternoon, Sister Eugene.
Good afternoon, and Jackie.
And the listening family.
Thank you.
Do not think the state has the right to suspend all safeguards in the name of public health crises. We in the United States, we have a constitution and bodies of law, and it's a very dangerous, slippery slope, and we're already sliding down it. And this is not the first time we see suspension of law. The difference is that it's here in America on these shores, but this has happened before. After 9/11, they set up all kinds of internment camps outside of the United States of America, but people were held. They weren't brought before court. They didn't have any system of due process or justice, and they had all types of secret activities as now trickling out the information about how people of other nations and other countries were treated in these places outside the United States. So now we're here at home, and it's the same concept, because where is the safeguard? Who determines what is crossing the line, and who determines what's in the public interest or what is for the best of the nation? We certainly can't just depend on the word of the elected officials. We can't depend on the word of the so-called scientists, the CDC. And the final thing is the manipulation of the masses through media.
So, in your view, is this right ironclad, even though we know we are facing a biological situation that changes almost minute by minute. Right. And becomes more and more threatening. It winds its way through communities and leaves hundreds of people dead. So time is of the essence. You have to move quickly. And this means that you may not necessarily be 100% on point with what most people consider the law. But you are doing... The major part of it is demonstrating a reaction. The reaction is to move swiftly to change lives. Now, to save lives, sorry. You don't see any reason to give an inch on the practical process here?
Okay, this is my position. Where is the stopgap? Where is the safeguard? Who determines that you suspend certain legal rights and issues? And where is there an examination of the practices and the policies of the government?
It's like, well, you know, here's another question. The question that follows your question is, there is no time. Okay. I'm moving on the basis of recommendations from very experienced people who have the best interests of the country at heart. But okay. There's no time to hold hearings. There's no time to get into deep conversations. There's no time to investigate any deeper what could happen if things are not tended to immediately. So we will risk being inexact in the short term while we get ourselves together for long-term policy decisions. But this is not the time. We don't have the time for major convocations and conferences.
Okay, I understand your question, and I know you're being provocative in some ways, but I'm not suggesting major convocations and conferences. I am suggesting, based on the evidence that we have so far, and I can preface my remarks by saying I have gotten the vaccine, okay? But I also am very leery of historical and scientific facts should make one leery of just submitting to everything and voluntarily giving up any rights that you may have. Now, the sad part about all this, and this is my personal opinion and observation, is that there's been a lot of time. There's been 2 years, and still weekly or even every 2 or 3 days, there's a different pronouncement about the virus and about the boosters and about the vaccines. And then that's one problem. So how do you trust in something that for 2 years they didn't know that they're going to need testing kits, and 2 years they didn't know that they need more sites to test people, and 2 years
exactly.
They haven't.
And even so, even though there is ample evidence that they were unprepared for this onslaught, do they just throw up their hands and say, well, we weren't prepared? Or do they make a major effort to tackle it, but that would involve some stringent applications? The law is depriving people of their constitutional protections.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, Patrice, because first of all,
okay, it's
some
okay.
of this stuff is you could see it coming down the pike. And just to say, oh, we're not prepared, that's not sufficient. Just the things that are happening now, right now, this week in our country, thousands of people stranded in airports, people stranded on highways. All of these things contribute also to the, if we believe the science, contribute to the distribution of the virus. If you have thousands of people cooped up,
yes, but you're missing the point of the question, though. All these things are true and evident and have been reported and documented. The fact still remains that every minute counts in terms of response to attenuate
the point is
the full impact of
we have that there's actual legitimate response. What proof do we have that there's an alternative viewpoint, an alternative way of tackling a problem? Why does everybody have to just march lockstep towards what, quote
Because
unquote,
this is the nature. People are still thinking that there is a lot of time. There's a big open window of time in which they can maneuver and study, and that is out. This is a pandemic. And we're talking about, it's like leprosy. When leprosy broke out and people were thinking, well, we have to study it, and no, you don't have time. You got to come up with something fast in order to save lives. And that may compromise individuals' constitutional protections.
I think it's very dangerous, very dangerous precedent.
Yes, it may be dangerous, but here's the thing. If you do risk, do you risk being dangerous or taking a dangerous action and saving thousands of lives? Or you follow procedure and you hold your conferences and you have your debates and whatnot, and people are dying by the minute. What do you do?
This is my point. We have to go by the evidence that's already before us in order to make come to some type of conclusion about future conduct. That's number one. Number two, there is no safeguard. Who is the government? Who is making the final decision that rights should be suspended? How are the rights restored? How do you move back from that?
You see, you are already in full bureaucratic mode. You're having a major problem. People are dying like flies.
People are also dying, I think, because of bureaucracy. People are dying because they can't
That is not an argument. The argument is, does the state have the right to supersede all the normal rights people think they have?
And my answer is no. The state does not have the right to supersede because there is no safeguard on who supervises the state. Who determines?
Oh, yeah, but that's a bureaucratic part of it. I want to get the philosophical attitude clear.
Well,
the state has no right whatsoever to even attempt to do something like that. It has no right to supersede anybody.
I'm not saying there's one extreme or the other extreme. I am saying that the state is made up of the people. The people are the ones who are the constituents of the state. The state
and they're dying.
Yes,
this is the point.
Dying.
All this is true. Nobody is denying what you're saying is true. It is true what you say. This is what we have been taught. This is what we have accepted. But you are in the middle, I want to repeat this, you are in the middle of a pandemic. And that is probably the reason that people aren't so pressed to figure out what in the situation are they prepared to give up and what they're not prepared to give up, because people are dropping like flies.
Well,
when you look at what has happened in countries where there have been breakouts of deadly diseases, they are not going to waste a minute talking about procedures and constitutional protections. At some point, somebody's got to make a decision, and that decision has for however long it lasts, that decision is about saving lives immediately, now.
May I ask you a question? What is the distinction between quarantine of individuals who have been identified with a disease and complete relaxation of any kind of constitutional and legal norms that the state...
You are firmly fixed in the bureaucracy of things. I am trying to get you to consider... Just listen for a second. Have you ever been exposed to a pandemic?
Yes, I'm exposed to it now in this lifetime.
No. Before this, this is not yet. No. Nobody, as bad as things are, people in the United States have not seen or experienced a pandemic. If you have, you will know this is not a time to pontificate. This is a time to action. This is what we got to do to solve the problem.
The problem is to save lives.
What
is the action that the state will take against its own people to save lives?
I have no idea.
What is it? So you just give them a blank check and say, do what you may and you know, let the chips fall where they may? Or do you say
that's insanity. You have already a system of checks and balances, supposedly. You have state legislators, legislatures, you have federal legislatures, you have local legislatures. You have organizations. You're not without help here in monitoring the actions of the state. But you have to do something now. We're late. And every hour that nothing is done, people are dying. What are you prepared to accept in terms of responsibility for needless deaths because bureaucratic things have gotten in the way?
First of all, my proposition or my supposition here is that 800,000 people died already because of bureaucratic do-nothing types of institutions. That's number one. Number two, we don't have any actual proof of what the government is capable of doing or not doing, and that's what troubles me. Now, you asked the earlier question on your show about why are so many people leaving elected office, and this all ties in together. Perhaps they're leaving because they've...
Yes, but you're not answering the question. You're taking us on a scenic tour. You're taking us on a scenic tour of your answer. It is a straightforward question.
Should the government
have the right in a situation of extreme emergency to enact certain things that we would normally consider injurious to our individual constitutional rights? That's the question. And you just said more than 800,000 people in the United States have already died. What's the magic number?
No, there is no magic number. I'm saying
exactly. Since 800,000 people have died, we can do what we have to do while another 800,000 people die.
I will say this in closing, respectfully. I don't agree with your position. I know that you want us to debate and examine questions, but no matter how long we talk or anybody else talks, I would never change my position that you give the government a blank check to do what the government...
Yeah, but don't say things as arbitrary as that. I will never change my position. It means that you're never going to reason it out. You don't know what you will do.
We don't know what we don't know all the information. We don't know all the answers.
There will never be a time in a pandemic. I keep saying people don't understand what a pandemic looks like.
A pandemic.
Have you ever been to a country in the throes of a pandemic?
A pandemic.
And see bodies on the street, dogs eating people, dead people, and so forth. It is traumatic. The United States has never seen things like that.
I understand that, but we've also seen Katrina. We've also seen all kinds of the internment
of nothing. Katrina is nothing compared to a pandemic.
I'm sure it's nothing, but it gives us evidence. It points to the inefficiency of a bureaucracy that has not addressed the needs and the circumstances.
And which bureaucracy are you willing to tell me now has been perfect?
None. None is known.
Exactly. We should start from that point. The bureaucracy is completely imperfect. They themselves have confessed. They don't know this disease. They don't know what's next. They don't know how it evolves. They don't know how it works.
Exactly.
But I'm still saying
exactly why
one thing is important, and that is preserving life. What leeway do you give or is permissible under these conditions to allow for what would seem to be, in normal circumstances, arbitrary decisions in order to address a serious emergency?
First of all, I agree it's a serious emergency. But I also agree there are many, many stumbling blocks that would hinder an effective program that would reach all peoples, regardless of their caste, their race, their ethnicity, their economic status. That's the first problem that we have here in America and many parts of the world. Delivery of
services. The first problem we have, I have to say, we have never... Perhaps only prior to the Civil War was the last time this country came close to a pandemic. But we have no real experience, certainly not recently, with pandemic-level emergencies.
I agree with that, but we also have some proof of how delivery of services have been administered in the past during emergencies. We can look at many, many instances in this country where delivery of services were not even and they were not effective. We can start right here in New York City.
You're talking very much in a bureaucratic way. I'm saying to you, do you understand? You yourself said the last figure you quoted was 800,000 people. The last numbers that came close to that in the story that I did had to do with the availability of drugs by the major drug manufacturers who to this day have not gone to jail.
Exactly. That's my point, Nitri.
We don't understand the nature of serious crises.
Does that mean that the availability of help is going to be addressed uniformly, regardless of people's class, status, and economic situation? No. The reason why so many people died, the so-called essential workers, were people who were, ACS case workers going up in the projects, the people driving the MTA workers, people working mopping floors in the
I know all of that.
Yes,
you talk about service people. I'm talking about how does a country or a state or a governmental body responsible for or
why weren't they identified as people that needed immediate emergency services?
Because first of all, they didn't even know what coronavirus was.
Trump Trump landed on the lawn with 12 doctors standing out there waiting for him to go in. He leaves the hospital. Yeah. He goes back to the White House where they have a medical suite in the White House for him.
But yes, what, because he's the president. What else do you expect?
It has to
He is the
economic
chief executive officer of the United States. That's what he's entitled to, and that's what he got.
All right. So then the man who's the mopping floors in the police department, he's not entitled to medical services?
I didn't say that.
I'm saying
I didn't say that at all.
Same level.
In fact, I am saying that we have to come to terms with this notion that we could take our time. It will all turn out okay. Follow procedures, because there are procedures. Have our meetings, have our confabs, and exchange experiences. And meanwhile, people are dropping dead in the street.
I'm not saying that, Yatrice. I'm saying that people are dropping dead in the street because there's many things that already exist has not been fairly and equitably administered.
Okay. We shall continue this discussion.
I am also saying that I will not trust a government that has a long history of the history that this government has. I won't go into all that.
We got it, but that wasn't the question. The question was not whether you trust the government. The question was, what do you assign in terms of authority to a government in a time like this? What is the degree of authority that you're willing to assign?
You have to have some trust in that authority. Or you just blindly say, oh, it's a pandemic, so do what you will with me and my family? I don't think
so. Who is saying that? Nobody's saying that. I'm asking a question.
I understand the question.
To what degree is the state going to have the authority to do something in response to a pandemic? It's not whether you trust the state or whether you think, things will be all right. No. These are not the questions I'm asking. It is a philosophical question, maybe, but it has to do with the reality that we're living now. I have to close because we're out of time. That means tomorrow we answer the questions of those people whose names I'm going to call. I'll call them tomorrow and give them due respect when I do call them. Thank you so much for today. And I like these kinds of conversations because when you have to give an answer, you can't just see it in a one-dimensional way. When you have to deal with a crisis, you can't deal with it in a one-dimensional way. You have to be prepared that there will be things that you have to deal with that you don't want to deal with. But you have to. If your interest is in saving lives, that comes first. Not meetings, not phone calls. That comes first. Thank you so much, everyone, for doing such a splendid job today and sharing your thoughts. We come back to this tomorrow. We're not done. Bye-bye.